Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, DNA barcodes to check out the foods we eat. And a scientist is in hot water over a document leak from a think tank. Here's a scientist soundbite.
The image that some people have in mind is being able to sit down to a restaurant meal and take out your smartphone and scan a barcode on the menu and find out more about the species, more about how the dish is prepared, but also about the species. Where was it fished? What fisherman caught this? When was it caught?
That's paleontologist David Schindel with the Smithsonian Institution. More with him later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
Two new studies by a Yale research team and published in the Journal of Neuroscience provide more detail about what happens in a teenager's brain when exposed to cocaine. Defensive structural changes take place in the brain, which are, in the words of these researchers, probably protective of the brain's neurocircuitry. Previous studies showed that vulnerability to cocaine is higher in adolescence, when there's a shift going on from an explosive and plastic growth phase in the brain to the more settled brains of adults. These new studies help explain why risk of drug abuse and addiction increase so dramatically when cocaine use begins during the teenage years.
Scientists announced on February 21st that observations from the Hubble Space Telescope have revealed a new class of exoplanet, a water-covered planet with a thick, steamy atmosphere. The planet, which astronomers call GJ1214b, orbits a red dwarf star, is about 2.7 times Earth's diameter, and weighs almost 7 times as much.
Stress and depression appear to contribute to our aging process by shortening telomeres, the protective caps on the ends of chromosomes. That's according to a study in the February 15th issue of Biological Psychiatry. As we age, these protective caps, or telomeres, naturally shorten over time. These findings show that stress and depression contribute to premature shortening of the telomeres.
On February 18th, a NASA-funded research team launched a rocket from Alaska's Poker Flat Research Range straight into the heart of the Aurora Borealis, or Northern Lights, in order to investigate space weather, that is, changing environmental conditions in near-Earth space, mostly caused by varying activity on the sun. The scientists are trying to learn how the Northern Lights, which are generated by solar storms, affect satellite signals here on Earth.
Electric cars might cause more overall pollution and might be more harmful to health than conventional gasoline-powered cars. In China, where electricity is generated primarily through the burning of fossil fuels, that appears to be the case. A research team from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, has found in China the potential for a more negative overall impact on both pollution and health from electric cars than from gasoline cars. Study authors say their results point to electric vehicles being attractive, but only if they're powered by clean energy sources. They also found that electric bikes had the lowest environmental impact in all of China. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. This week's Song of the Week is called Everything's Eventual by 2012 South by Southwest showcasing artist The Black and White Years.
In every way, we go together. We are alike. We complement each other. Ah, that's right. At last I have it, even better than I imagined. I can't believe I nearly gave it up. I nearly watched the dream collapsing. I can't believe it. Even sleeping, I wouldn't dream it. Understandably, I'm feeling satisfied. What an odd and incredible feeling. This is the pinnacle. Everything's eventual. Now I'm not sure exactly what I'm waiting for. This is my fantasy. Exactly how I dreamed it'd be. What's this? A smile. Goodness, it must have been a while. It must have been a while. We go together. We are the same. We
need each other in every way. We go together, we are alike, we complement each other. Ah, that's right. This is my everything. I see my future brightening. I clutched my dream. This time it stayed till morning. This is my fantasy. Exactly how I dreamed to be. What's this? A smile. Goodness, it must have been a while. At last I have it. Go together than I imagined. I can't believe I nearly gave it up. I nearly watched the dream collapsing. I can't believe it. It's even I wouldn't dream it. Understandably, I'm feeling satisfied. What an odd and incredible feeling. I can't believe it. Even sleeping, I wouldn't dream it. Understandably, I'm feeling satisfied. What an odd and incredible feeling.
We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. DNA barcoding might soon arrive on dinner plates to help restaurants and seafood suppliers identify what we eat. Scientists involved hope that DNA technology to identify species will help prevent the widespread mislabeling of seafood, which results in cheaper fish being sold as a more expensive variety. In late 2011, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the use of DNA barcoding in the restaurant industry. Here to talk more about it is invertebrate paleontologist David Schindel with the Smithsonian Institution. He's the executive secretary of the Consortium for the Barcode of Life, which includes natural history museums and other biodiversity research organizations that are developing a global system for identifying species using short genetic sequences. He joins us from the studios of WAMU in Washington. Dr. Schindel, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So what are DNA barcodes?
DNA barcodes strictly are DNA sequence data records. They are a very specific sequence of A's, T's, G's, and C's taken from the same portion of the genome of all organisms that are sampled. And these records go into GenBank. GenBank is the U.S. National Institutes of Health gigantic gene sequence database, but it's basically a sheet of data. You can fit them on one page, and the core of it is the name of a species and a sequence of about 650 letters that we think is the signature of that species.
What is done with this information? From what I understand, like anybody can take this information and find out what it is.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. There's some kids in a high school in New York. It started a few years ago with the daughter of one of my colleagues who got interested in this. She was interested in particular in seafood because she liked sushi. So she wanted to verify what she was actually getting. Expensive sushi in New York, you'd like to get what you're paying for. So she sampled fish in supermarkets, in seafood markets, and in sushi restaurants. Now, since then, the students went on eBay and bought $44,000, bought the equipment necessary to get all the way up to sequencing. They didn't buy a sequencer, but all the stuff to do the extractions and the PCR amplification, and they put it on a kitchen table. And they were preparing things for sequencing. And, you know, it takes a few hours to a day to prepare samples, and they shipped it off to a commercial sequencing lab, and you know, for maybe, I don't know, $20, $30 per sample, they got an identification. So it's not the sort of thing that you do in on your own as an individual, but it's something that high school classes are doing now across the country. It's starting to find its way into the curriculum. So this is not cutting edge to the degree that only very expensive labs can do it, but it's not quite down to the point of being a consumer product either.
Tell us how these DNA barcodes are being used in the food industry and restaurants. Walk me through the scenario. What's happening here?
Yeah. If you think about the supply chain of fish, fishermen bring fish on shore. Most of the time, it's with the skin and head still on, and it's sold as whole fish. But increasingly, as the fishing industry becomes industrialized, the fish are processed on boat, and they come ashore as fillets. Now, once the skin and head is off of fish, it can be very difficult to identify the species. So when they come ashore, an organization or an agency like the Food and Drug Administration might take samples on some random or focused basis. Maybe 6 hours later, you have identifications of everything that was sampled. Studies that we've done, colleagues in Canada have done, show anywhere from 30 to 50% fraudulent labeling, either in seafood markets or in restaurants. So I think restaurants are going to be doing the same thing. Distributors, markets, restaurants will want to be able to label their product as DNA barcode tested. All the way to going to a restaurant, here's the experience that I'm looking forward to. When I go to a restaurant, of course, I'd like to know more about what I'm eating, the wine I'm ordering. I'd like to learn a little bit more about where it came from. The image that some people have in mind is being able to sit down to a restaurant meal and take out your smartphone and scan a barcode on the menu and find out more about the species, more about how the dish is prepared, but also about the species. Where was it fished? What fisherman caught this? When was it caught? Was it tested? Does this fisherman have a good record of authentic labeling? And all of that could be on your smartphone while you enjoy a glass of wine and you wait for your meal to be served. I think that would be not just comforting to me as a consumer, but it would enrich the dining experience. And also, when you go to the supermarket now, for example, some supermarkets, you'll see the green and blue and orange labeling about the sustainability of those fish stocks. So it allows you to make a decision about where do you want to eat on the food chain, large fish or small fish? Where do you want to eat on the food chain politically and economically about sustainability? And where do you want to eat on the food chain biologically in terms of the species you're eating? If you're a real foodie over time and you have confidence in the species that you're being served, it'll allow you to focus in more of, well, can I taste the difference between this snapper and that snapper species? If things are fraudulently labeled, you'll have no way of knowing. So so to all the seafood aficionados out there, caveat emptor, beware of what you're buying, but when we have barcode testing in the marketplace, you'll have much more confidence that you're really getting what you think you're getting. So enjoy it.
You've been listening to David Schindel with the Consortium for the Barcode of Life. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We invite you to join our community for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about something that's been making big news for those who follow the latest on climate change, the admission by a scientist that he deceived an organization to obtain and leak confidential documents. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. This story actually broke on February 14th, 2012, and the story as it first came out was that documents had been surreptitiously obtained from the Heartland Institute, which is a nonprofit organization based in Chicago.
And what's that?
Well, the Heartland Institute says on its About page that its mission is to discover, develop, and promote free market solutions to social and economic problems. So they're like free market folks. They're on the right side of the political spectrum.
Yeah, they're a policy think tank in Chicago, based out of Chicago, Illinois.
Exactly. And so what happened is that the Heartland Institute has been concerned with the subject of climate. And you can see on their website that they are concerned with it. I want to emphasize that they are not scientists at the Heartland Institute. It's not a scientific organization. It is, as you said, Jorge, a think tank. Well, on February 14th, the story broke that these surreptitiously obtained documents indicated who was funding the Heartland Institute and who the Heartland Institute was then funding with those dollars to basically convince people that global warming is not real And even if there is some climate change going on, that human beings aren't causing it.
They also talked about funding for scientists, how funding from the Institute actually goes into the pockets of some scientists, as well as outlining a strategy for bringing an opposing view to conventional climate science into classrooms.
That's right. And the document that talks about classrooms is one of the ones that's being most disputed by the Heartland Institute. But basically, these documents do show that the Heartland Institute is being paid. And the Heartland Institute is in turn paying this money out to scientists and to journalists, to bloggers, to basically say that climate change, that human-caused climate change, is not real.
And people now have been quick to point out that this sounds a lot like what happened in December of 2009, when emails were stolen and leaked out from climate scientists, referred to as Climate Gate.
Right, and people are calling this Denial Gate. So in the case in 2009, scientists' emails were stolen, and those scientists, in many cases, looked arrogant, and they talked like scientists. And I mean, we here at Erskine are used to hearing scientists talk, so in a way weren't surprised by hearing the tone of their emails. But I guess people in the public were somewhat surprised to hear some arrogance and some, you know, maybe even some dissembling on the part of these scientists. Now it's a different situation because now the documents were, I don't want to say stolen, but they were surreptitiously obtained from an organization on the other side of this climate debate.
So what's the latest?
Well, so what happened on the evening of February 20th is that a scientist stepped forward. Actually, a very well-known scientist, Peter Glick, who is who we've interviewed several times here on Earth Sky about water issues. Peter Glick stepped forward and said, "I am the one who obtained the documents from the Heartland Institute." And apparently what Peter Glick did was he used a false name to obtain these documents. So that has really added a whole new wrinkle to this story. And now today, many people are responding to that story, and it's been interesting to see those responses.
Yeah, this has been a pretty heated ethical debate. There's been discussions as to what did he do wrong? What did he, you know, I guess these documents, they've been partially verified by the Associated Press. So working on the assumption that these documents are real, did the scientists do something wrong to bring them to light?
Yeah, because some people on one side of this argument are, of course, saying, no, absolutely not. He should not have obtained these documents. He should not have leaked them to the press. It's wrong. It's ethically wrong. It's morally wrong. He should not have done that. But then, you know, it really surprised us this morning when a lot of people came down on the other side and said, well, he did it for a good cause, and there's something very nefarious that's going on in the United States today with this private money being used to fund people to say things that they really don't know are true. I mean, here are climate scientists working with physics and working with supercomputers and doing their best to understand what's happening with climate and drawing the conclusion that indeed climate change is occurring, the Earth is getting warmer, using data sets to say that, in fact, many of the years in the past 10 years have been the warmest years on record. And then to have an organization, the Heartland Institute, allegedly paying people to say exactly the opposite of that. No, it's actually getting cooler, and there's no evidence that climate is getting warmer. It's been very strange.
Right, and journalists have kind of jumped on this one, too, to point out that it's not ethical to obtain sources, to obtain documents, to deceive people in order to get information, or to misrepresent yourself, basically, you know, and that is what Dr. Glick did.
Well, I think Dr. Glick, you know, is going to become the sacrificial lamb here because there's no question but that his career is going to take a major hit. But, you know, it will only be in hindsight that we'll be able to say whether this was a good thing or a bad thing in terms of shedding light on, you know, a situation that maybe needs to have some light shed on it.
Yeah. So what do you think? What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I've followed this story for many decades, and, you know, it started in the late 1970s. Scientists began saying, we think that if people continue, you know, putting CO2 into the atmosphere, that the Earth is going to get warmer. And you know, decade after decade, the studies continue to roll in every kind of way you could think of, showing it's getting warmer. Animals are shifting their ranges northward. Ocean temperatures are warmer. Air temperatures are warmer. And to see this called a debate when, in fact, it's just been the process of science rolling along for decades now, trying to understand what's happening on the Earth today. And, of course, climate is one of the most complicated things to try to understand. So I have really been dismayed, personally, to see that so many people don't accept what the climate scientists are saying. And, indeed, surveys show that 98% to 99% of climate scientists agree it is getting warmer and humans are part of the reason.
Yeah, I mean, I really felt like it was just a punch in the gut, you know, when I came across this news, because the public trusts scientists, right? And there's a good reason for that. What they do is based on reality. And when scientists start messing around with politics in this way, it really gives everyone a black eye.
Well, we'll see. I think it could go either way. I think Glick could come out of this in some circles looking like a hero.
Time will tell.
That's right.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. There are too many.